Today, from WNYC, Snap Judgment proudly presents The Breakout Special. Performed live in San Francisco, you get the very best seat in the house, because it's about to be on. Snap Judgment, live.
Okay, so I was a young lad living in Detroit, Michigan, enjoying myself. But my parents said, no. We're taking y'all out to the country, middle of nowhere, gonna be farmers. I didn't appreciate it, but they bribed me. And as a little kid, I got a trapper keeper, you know. I had a Scooby-Doo lunchbox, yo. I had one of those hats with the propeller on top of it. I was ready to go on the first day of school. I said, go ahead, go on to school. And I went down the driveway to wait for the school bus. This was a new thing for me, school bus. So I was out there. And I saw it coming down the road. You could hear the kids screaming, hollering, and yelling, and shouting. The school bus pulls up. Go on in here. I step in, and it goes silent. See, there weren't any black families in rural Michigan for about 100 square miles. No one had gotten the memo that one had arrived. So I just went to go sit down in the first seat I saw next to this little toe-headed boy. And he spit in the seat. I kept walking. Spit. And I'm getting near the end of the bus. Sit yourself down, Blaze, we gotta go. Everyone's shouting, they're yelling now. You know what they're calling me. And I get all the way to the back of the bus. And I can't turn around. They're shouting, they're screaming, they're yelling. I can't turn around. It's a little girl. She has her backpack on the seat. She moves it, and I sit down, and we ride. I don't say a word to her. I don't say anything to her. We ride, go to school. The next day, the shouting, the screaming, the hollering, I go right back to the back of the bus, and Mary Jo. I know her name is Mary Jo now. Mary Jo moves her backpack, and I sit down. We do not speak. We just ride. And that's how it goes every single day until the middle of the school year, they switch things up. And instead of being the last one on the bus, now I'm the first. But force of habit, I go right back to my regular seat. Now, in rural Michigan, nobody's rich, but some of us are really, really poor. Poor farm families where you don't have enough insulation on your water makes your pipe freeze in the middle of the winter. But you still have to do your chores. You still have to clean the barn. Still have to get chicken filth all over you. And when that happens in a cold Michigan winter, you have one of two choices. You can either go to school covered in filth, or you can try to hide it with some cologne. This day, Mary Jo went the Cologne route. And when she got on that bus, it smelled like a skunk wrapped in rotten flowers. And the kids screamed and shouted and hollered. And Mary Jo, she looked right back at me. I looked away. I'd had enough. I was hoping she'd find, I just hoped she'd find somewhere else to sit. But she walked back. She walked back, the hollering, the screaming, the shouting, the yelling. She walked back, and there I was, with my backpack on the seat. I waited. And I moved there. She sat down. And I was so ashamed. The hollering, screaming, the shouting, I didn't care. I just wanted to tell her, I was sorry. So I said, hey, my name's Glenn. I know your name. What are you talking about? So, we talked. All the screaming and hollering, it just went away. We talked to two little kids in the back of the bus. Now then, I can't tell you how happy we ought to be here today. I am thrilled to come to this stage one more time with some of the best storytellers in all the land. And you might not know this, but I brought some friends. Please say hello if you would. Give a warm welcome, Mr. Alex Mandel. David Brandt on the sticks. David Brandt on the sticks. Got Tim Frick. Tim Frick. We call this one. Gonna show the breakout special. A little something, something. Now, our first storyteller tonight, this guy, he's an amazing brother. In fact, he was just nominated by the NAACP as the best playwright for a play that he wrote. He's got a current play going on at the Marsh. We're excited to have him on this stage. Please welcome Mr. Don Reed.
I grew up on East 14th in Oakland, California. When I was like 20 years old, I got recruited to UCLA on a speech and debate scholarship, a partial scholarship. But nobody told me that partial scholarship, loosely translated, actually stands for not enough money. Yeah, I was suffering bad. I was really excited when I first headed off for UCLA. I hopped on a plane. Landed in L.A., starry-eyed, and realized I didn't have nowhere to live. Hadn't quite thought that part out yet, right? So what I did was, every day after class, I went to a different dorm room and I partied. Went to a different dorm room and partied every night. Party, party, party. Yeah. Dancing white to fit in. Hi, how are you? How are you doing? How are you? How are you? And crashed in a different dorm room every night. But they caught on to me. So then I slept in the movie theater, and they caught on to me. So then I got a brilliant idea to sleep in the girls' restroom at UCLA. They had those little couches, you know, those little period couches? Those little, it's my time of the month, you might back up, I might choke you couches. I sleep in those. Now, the building where the speech team met had a lot of those couches. Kinsey Hall, built in 1929 with words of wisdom etched in stone over the doorway. But I never read it. So I sneak in there and sleep, but I never got good rest because I didn't want anybody to walk in on me. So I kind of slept with one eye open all night, like. I didn't want some girl to walk in and say, Suzanne, Suzanne, there's a Negroid in the women's restroom. Alert the authorities, right? I knew I needed somewhere to live. I needed a job. So I went to the classifieds and I found an excellent opportunity. Seeking neat, clean college students to serve breakfast to the elderly in an upscale environment. Beverly Hills Hancock Park adjacent. The Kipling Hotel for your busy, friendly, happy retirement. I waited tables some up here in the Bay. I'm like, I gotta get this. I caught the bus over there. It was almost as if classical music was playing in my head as I passed luscious lawns and stunning mansions. This was gonna be the next level of my life. We rode by a golf course. People waved at me. I was on the bus. But the bus went way, way past all that night. And I ended up in a nasty area with trash on the ground. Heard errant gunshots. Pow, 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 pow. Woo! Police helicopter. A little scroungy dog ran by. Looked like he gave me the finger. How do you give the finger with a paw? I stepped off the bus, and there was the Kipling in all its non-fantasticness. I walked into the lobby, and I was immediately met by the scent of urine and log cabin syrup. Kind of nasty, but kind of sweet. I went through the interview. It went well. They told me they'd let me know. They did let me know. I got it. Serving breakfast to the elderly for room and board. Now, every day after you finish your shift, you had to kind of rush through the lobby because the old folks would be camped out in the lobby and they try to capture you with a long-ass boring story. The kind that destroys your soul. The kind that while you're listening, you go, am I dying as I'm listening to this? Did you just reference Custer? How long have you been on the planet? So you had to do this little move where you kind of jog through the lobby and point your watch like, I got things to do, I got things to do. But sometimes I just slowed down and I got to know some of them. I got to know this one old guy named George. One day he was standing in the dining room, you know, kind of Catskills type dining room with a green linoleum floor and cheap curtains that wanted to be much nicer. And George, standing there 5'2" with his little dead finger, he's like, Don, hold on just a second. I want to talk to you for a second, Don. I want to talk to you. I have a situation, and you're a smart guy. You serve me my breakfast each morning. I want to know if you think what I'm thinking about doing is a good idea, okay, Don? Okay, look over here, okay? Look right there. That's my seat. Every day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, everybody knows that that's my seat. But now there's this new guy, an old guy. He just plops in my seat. He plots in my seat. He's giving me the spilkas, this guy. This guy's giving me the spilkas, okay? Okay, I'm thinking about doing something. I want to know if you think it's a good idea, okay? I'm thinking of going up behind him and stabbing him in the back of the head with a fork. You think that's a good idea? To stab him in the back of the head with a fork. You think that? Look at him. Watch him. Watch the son of a bitch. Watch him chew. I hate that guy. I'm too old for this. I'm 92 years old, okay? My wife died 25 years ago. Every night I say my prayers. I say, dear God, when I wake up, please let me be dead. I wake up, damn it, still alive.
So how are things going for you?
I said, they're going pretty good, George, but I'm having a hard time staying in school financially, and I really just want to be a comedian. He said, you could do that. You could go to school and be a comedian. You know, people can make it through anything. People can do anything. They're resilient. Trust me. I've been through a lot. Let me tell you a story, Don, okay? I used to live overseas. And one day, they marched into our area and they say that we're going to be prisoners of war. We're like, okay, we're going to be prisoners of war, right? But what they did, Don, is they took us to this camp, and then they tell us that we're just going to be held. Don, you see these numbers on my arm right here? He pointed to some numbers tattooed on his forearm. They put those on me there. And so one day, a soldier walks in dressed in all black, and he says, it's time to take a shower. Now, we knew some folks that headed off to these showers. We don't quite remember seeing them again. Didn't know if they were transferred. Confusing. But we change clothes. We get in line. It's almost my group's turn to walk inside these showers. And Allied soldiers, British, American, I don't know, they show up and pop, pop, pop. They shoot the guys in the black. Pop, pop, pop. They shoot the SS guys in the black. And they freed us. And that's why you'll never hear me say an ill word about a soldier that's fighting for good. They try to say all soldiers are murderers. They're all killers. But sometimes you got to do that. Sometimes you got to fight when someone's trying to wipe out your entire culture. You got to fight. You better fight. You got to fight, Don. But you don't have time to listen to all that stuff. You're real busy and you got a lot to do. I said, that's okay, George. He said, Don, did I ever tell you I had a beautiful wife? She was beautiful. She had this song. Well, I'd sing it to her. I sing the song to her. Hold on. You are most beautiful girl in the whole wide world. You are beautiful girl. Da 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 da. It's a short song, I made it up. But then I tell you, I've lived a good life. I treat people well. I keep my word. That's a big thing. You gotta keep your word. You gotta keep your word, Don. But I've lived too damn long. 92 years old, every night I still say my prayers. Dear God, when I wake up, let me be dead. I wake up, damn it, still here. And you know what, Don? You know what they still give me? I'm 92. You know what they still give me? My driver's license. You better watch out for me. I'll run you right down. I lived and worked at the Kipling for 5 years. Serving breakfast to the elderly, and they served me stories. I left the Kipling, and things went very, very well for me. Many, many years later, I got a big project working with a huge star. Her name rhymes with Mopra. I wanted to remember being hungry because things were going so well. I wanted to remember being really hungry. So what I did, I swear to God, I went back to UCLA to the very building where I used to sleep in the girls' restroom. The very building. While standing outside, I looked up and I finally looked at those words of wisdom that were etched in stone over the doorway. They say, "Nothing is too wonderful to be true." It's a quote from a scientist, Faraday. "Nothing is too wonderful to be true." And guess what's etched in stone over the doorway of the Kipling Hotel? Not that. I think it's scratching with a butcher knife. It says something like, "Lick my nuts," or something like that. But nothing is too wonderful to be true. It could be my old buddy George, who grew to 92 and beat the Nazis. He beat the Nazis and finally, happily, woke up dead. Or you could be me, who grew up in Oakland, headed off to college, was homeless for a while, but battled through, and ended up here with you on this wonderful night. Or something like that.
Snap Judgment Live, the breakout special will continue in a moment. Stay tuned.
Mr. Don Lee, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Don Lee.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment Live, the breakout special. My name is Glenn Washington, and most of us want to be part of a crowd. No one likes to be cast out. But we know sometimes when you walk out to the fringe, sometimes good things happen. J.W. Taylor tells us his story live for the wonderful storytelling event, Tales from the South.
It was 1 a.m. when Brother Benji set me and Dana McDuffie down in his office. Dana was looking at me, and Brother Benji too. But I focused on the cross on the wall behind his desk and tried to breathe. "You kids have two options," he said. "Option one, I pick up that phone, call your parents, and tell them to come get you. And I'll let you explain why. Now, brothers and sisters, listen to me. I didn't care if option two meant being stripped naked, dipped in honey, and rolled in fire ants while singing all six verses of Amazing Grace. I was going with option number two. Now, I knew Brother Benji wouldn't kill me and bury me in the backyard, but I wasn't so sure about Mama. I was 14, the summer of 1985, the night of the youth lock-in at Calvary Baptist in Shreveport, Louisiana. For the teenagers, a church lock-in was a stay-up-as-late-as-you-like extravaganza, a night away from home with movies, music, pizza, games, and a bit of hair-pulling mixed with the occasional slap fight. For the parents, it was even better. With a promise to pick them up at 8 the next morning, they began dropping their darlings off at 6 p.m., and by 6:15, the church parking lot was enveloped in a thick black fog smelling suspiciously of burning rubber. The man in charge of the 40-plus teens was Brother Benji, the youth minister, who was an angry little man with slumped shoulders, a squatty face, thick glasses, and the joyful spirit of a man under a perpetual IRS audit. He had shooed us into the fellowship hall and led us in prayer before outlining the rules that no one in the room intended to follow. Then he turned us loose. I grabbed some pizza and talked to some friends, all while watching Dana McDuffie. For weeks, Dana and I had been engaged in that time-honored teenage courtship ritual of circling each other like feral cats. Staring and preening and puffing, neither willing to make the first move. Feats of strength and fluttered lashes, a bicep flex and a hair flip. Cologne and perfume applied in such copious amounts that we could smell one another through walls. It was all prelude and preparation for tonight. I decided tonight was the night. But I was nervous. I was new to the game of love, but Dana had what we in the evangelical community called a reputation. And unlike leprosy or rickets, you couldn't take vitamin D or rub some aloe vera on a reputation and make it all better. A reputation was terminal. But I didn't care. I decided. So around midnight, when I found Dana alone as she was coming out of the girls' bathroom, I made my move. Want to talk? That was my move. I had practiced it for weeks in the mirror, but then Dana threw me a curveball. Talk about what? Now, if my move had been a ship, they'd have been ringing bells and handing out life jackets because there was 6 foot of water in the boiler room. In my practice mirror sessions, Dana had always responded either yes or no. I was woefully unprepared for her to answer my question with a question. So I just stood there in the wreckage of my move, the smell of my own sweat and a half bottle of Stetson burning my nostrils. Dana gave me kind of a sideways look, like the RCA dog. And then she smiled, and she grabbed my hand, and we ran through a side door into the church courtyard. We found another open door, and she led me up some stairs and down some others until eventually we arrived in the elementary Sunday school wing. At the end of a long hall, we opened the door to the first grade classroom. I turned on the light. She turned it off. Shortly thereafter, we commenced to sinning. Now, I may have been new to the game of love, but it didn't take me long to figure out that we weren't playing the same game. Dana was playing bridge and chess and backgammon all at the same time. I was hitting rocks with hammers. Yet, just about the time I was learning how to hold my own, I was blinded by a bright light. Not unlike what I imagine Saul experienced on the road to Damascus. Only instead of God's voice, I heard Brother Benji's. And to this day, I don't know how he found us or how he even knew we were missing. But he had called us at play on the fields of love, and he promptly called the game on account of darkness in our souls. And so the long, slow walk back to his office. He sat us down and shut the door. Took off his thick glasses and tossed them on his desk. He rubbed his wee little face. Rubbed it again. I looked at Dana. She looked at me. Silence. "You should be ashamed," he said. "Ashamed. This is God's house, a place of worship, and you two have turned it into a den of iniquity." Thus began an impromptu sermon on the evils of the flesh. And as he spoke, I was struck by two almost simultaneous revelations. One, for the first time in my life, I was a fornicator. Two, I should not have been quite so happy about it. I had committed a real, live, grown-up sin, and it was all I could do to keep the smile in my heart from reaching my face. But my parents didn't take me to church every Wednesday and twice on Sunday for nothing. My temporary euphoria was replaced by the cold and creeping feeling that now, after 14 years, all 10 of the commandments were suddenly in play. Instead of just keeping the Sabbath holy and honoring my mom and dad, now I had to watch out for coveting my neighbor's wife, along with bearing false witness, whatever that was, and murdering and thieving and adultery. A whole new world was opening up, and I was afraid it was going to swallow me whole. "Are you listening?" Brother Benji said. "Yes, sir." Then he gave us the options. Call our parents, or option two. And so it came to pass that option number two led us back to the fellowship hall, to a small raised stage in the front of the room. The congregation before us, Brother Benji behind us. And in a loud voice, Brother Benji did say, "J.W. Taylor, confess before your peers and your God, and lo, I froze. Never had 40-plus teenagers been so quiet. The whole scene seemed like a photograph, a still life. No one was moving except me. As bad as I was shaking on the outside, it was worse on the inside. Voices and laws and rules and commandments were swirling in my head. Love and lust and heaven and hell all blurred together until I couldn't figure out what I needed to confess because I couldn't keep track of all my sins. JW, the voice said. Dana took my hand. Her hand was as warm as mine was cold. I took a deep, shaky breath and said, me and Dana went to the Sunday school rooms and kissed and stuff. The voice. And what you did was wrong, wasn't it? Yes, sir. And you won't do it again, will you? No, sir. Dana let go of my hand. I had a lot to learn. And again, the voice. Dana McDuffie, confess before your peers and your God. And then it happened. Dana took two steps forward to the front and center of the stage, and she confessed, and confessed, and confessed. In fact, she confessed in such vivid and salacious detail that Brother Benji tried to keep her from confessing anymore. But that only made her confess louder. And the louder she confessed, the smaller Brother Benji became, until he receded completely into the background of the great passion play that was unfolding before him. And the more Dana confessed about what had transpired in that first grade Sunday school room, the more I began to wonder whether I'd even been there. It was a tour de force of repentance. And when Dana finally finished her stem-winding confession, the wee little man behind her didn't ask if what she had done was wrong or if she was going to do it again. He just stepped down off the stage and walked right out the doors of the fellowship hall, leaving me and Dana and our peers and our God to figure out what to do next. When I woke up later that morning, Dana was gone. My parents picked me up and I rode home in silence. I went to bed and slept another 6 hours without dreaming a single dream. I never saw Dana McDuffie inside the walls of Calvary Baptist Church again, but I saw her again the next Friday night, and the one after that, and the one after that.
We want to thank J.W. Taylor for telling his story. That piece was recorded and produced by the folks over at Tales from the South. And they've got plenty more where this came from. Check out their podcast at talesfromthesouth.com. We're going to have a link at snapjudgment.org. You're listening to Snap Judgment Live. And if you dig the stories you've been hearing so far, understand Snap Live is on tour right now with a brand new show. Portland, Seattle, Detroit, Minneapolis, San Francisco, with more cities being added, and every single show is sold out, so get tickets now at snapjudgment.org while you can. In just a moment, the closer himself, James Judd. Stay tuned. Amongst the 2016 election craziness, the stump speeches, the tweets, what is really going on? What does it take to win the most powerful job in the world? You can't understand today's candidates without listening to yesterday's. What do you know about Shirley Chisholm, the black woman who ran for president in 1972 and paved the way for both Obama and Hillary? Seriously, she is the boss. Do you know what Howard Dean thinks went wrong with his campaign? Or how George Bush beat John McCain in the primaries? Learn about the strategic choices and human moments that determine who wins and who loses this blood sport we call presidential elections. The Contenders. 16 for 16 is a new series from my favorite, stay interesting source, Ozzy, airing on PBS starting Tuesday, September 13th at 8 p.m. 9 Central and every consecutive Tuesday leading up to the election. Learn more at Ozzy. OZY.com. From WNYC, you're listening to Snap Judgment Live, the Breakout Special. My name is Glenn Washington, and this next story does mention a house of ill repute. You should know that. Just in case you care, I'm jealous of you regardless, because Snap is about to drop a bomb.
Here at the Snap, we call up a closer. Please put your hands together for Mr. James Judd.
Well, nobody said don't come on stage with a martini and a tambourine. The late 1990s, like the year 2000, the height of the first great dot-com boom, and San Francisco was its epicenter. So I thought, I've got to get in on this. People were becoming millionaires overnight. Money was just falling from the sky. People were going to work in their pajamas. They were bringing their dogs. They were playing ping pong. It was an amazing time like we'll never experience again, except for like right now. So I thought, I gotta get in on this. But what can I do? Well, I look in the want ads and I find an ad for this big fancy technology magazine that's looking for someone with legal and technology knowledge. I think, well, this is perfect. I have some legal knowledge and I use technology, so how hard can it be to write about it? I send in my resume and immediately the editor-in-chief calls me in. And he looks at my resume and he says, well, this is a very impressive resume, but I don't actually see here that you have any experience in the technology sector. We're the biggest technology magazine out there. We cover all the major players and issues. Do you know anything about technology? And I say, no. He said, well, can you start Tuesday? And just like that, I'm hired. And they start sending me out immediately in all these exotic places like Cupertino and Los Gatos, the cat, and the Milpitas and Fremont. It's very exotic and I'm loving it. And one day my boss says, pack your bags, you're going to China. Well, there's one little twist to the story. A couple days earlier, this spy plane was forced to land off the coast of China. Anyone remember that? So the Chinese government has said there's going to be no more visas for U.S. journalists. It's not going to happen, no way, no how. So my boss wants me to sneak into China as a tourist, interview these five guys he's got picked out, and get home without getting caught. Well, it seems like kind of a bad time to be trying to pull a fast one on the Chinese government. But you know what? I weigh my options. I think, well, I could refuse to go on moral grounds, but possibly lose my job and lose my house and lose my boyfriend. Or I could go to China and risk getting caught and I wind up in a Chinese prison and I wake up one day missing my kidneys. I'm going to China! And I'm gonna go because I'm gonna be there on my 36th birthday, and I think it will be great. Great luck to celebrate my 36th birthday by standing on the Great Wall of China. At least this is what I tell the people at the embassy near the Kabuki Hot Springs, which, by the way, is fabulous. You should definitely go there if you can. And, well, they, you know, they kind of have a little qualm, but then they stamp my passport and I'm off. And I get on the plane, then I fade to black. And when I wake, I'm in China. Well, I put on my blue pinstripe suit, I put on my red tie, my shiny black shoes, I rush out of the hotel to find a limousine waiting for me. And next to the limousine is a very tall guy in a black hat, mirrored sunglasses, black tie, black suit. He says, call me Mr. Gu. And I get into the back of the limousine, and the five guys I've come to interview are already seated around this limousine. We're gonna drive around Beijing because they don't wanna be seen with a US journalist. Now, these five guys were all born in China, but they were educated in the United States, and they made millions of dollars on Wall Street, maybe billions of dollars. And now, they've all moved back to China, where together, they have a plan to make China the leader in the world's technology race. And they're talking about, I don't know. But here's what I do. When I don't know what people are saying, which is most of the time, I don't know what these people are talking about. I mean, I can't even spell the words that are coming out of their mouths. I bring out a little tape recorder and I say, I'm not going to take notes. Instead, I'm here to listen to you. So we're driving around Beijing and all of a sudden somebody pulls out a bottle of mysterious Chinese liquor and everyone goes, hooray! And then shot glasses come out and they pass it around the limousine and everyone goes, hooray! And I take a sip of it. It tastes like a combination of black licorice and gasoline. I dub it Licoline. And it goes around and around and around and everyone goes, hooray! And pretty soon everyone is really drunk. And then one of the guys turns to one of the other guys and goes, hey, why don't we take James with us and show him how deals are really close in China? And Mr. Goose speeds up. And when we stop and we step out, we're in the shadow of a giant neon hula girl. And her eyes are blinking and her hips are shaking. And she's playing the ukulele beneath two giant, pink, blinking, naked breasts. And I think, okay, well, a night of giant, naked breasts would be my second choice. Well, somebody rings the doorbell, and a woman with a beehive and a riding crop answers the door, and she goes, hooray! And all the guys go, hooray! Well, Madame Riding Crop leads us through a maze of corridors, of doors with little windows. And finally she opens the door and we step inside one of them. And it's kind of a small room with green shag carpeting and wood paneling, a couch, a coffee table, and a TV set. And we stand there awkwardly in silence for a few moments. And then Mr. Goo opens the door and in marches a line of girls. And they're all kind of tall and they have big hair and like sparkly tube tops and those very shiny, too much information Celine Dion pants. Except for one small girl at the end in a black cocktail dress and a side pony, really very chic. And one of the guys turns to me and he says, pick one. I say, oh. No. I'm here to listen to you. He says, custom dictates that you've got to choose before we can choose, so you got to pick one. All the guys start going, pick one, pick one, pick one, pick one, pick one. I think, hey, her. And I point to the girl at the end in a little black cocktail dress, because I think that'll look the nicest next to my blue pinstripe suit. And she comes over and she says, my name is Lisa, but I know it's the only thing she can say in English. And all the guys go, hooray! And they pick the girls and everyone goes, hooray! And then we all sit on the couch and Madame Roddy Crop brings out another bottle of Licorice and everyone goes, hooray! And pretty soon everyone is taking shots of Licorice and singing Desperado. That TV comes to life as a karaoke machine. The guys start getting up and singing. Well, first of all, conversation between me and Lisa is strained at best. And my little laminated Chinese handy expressions card in my wallet doesn't include anything I care about, like, is it hard to find good skincare products in China? Or do you have a brother nearby? Awkward. Well, Madame Ronnie Crop takes a couple at the end of the couch and she leads them out. They're gone for about a half an hour. And they come back. No one says a word about it. Then she takes the next couple and they leave. And the next one and the next one. Until pretty soon, Lisa and I are the last ones left in line. Well, I see Madame Ronnie Crop coming toward me. And she's got that look in her eye. Like, okay, gringo, it's your turn to see the big round bed in the back. I panic, I get up, I grab the microphone from whoever has it. I say, ha, it's my turn to sing. And I press through the list of songs, I press play. If I could turn back time. Chastity. Now, Lisa has an expression on her face that needs no translation. Because that expression means the same thing in every language of every country on the planet. There is something just not right.
about this guy. Am I gonna get a tip?
Well, Madame Riding Crop keeps coming toward me, and now I'm really panicked. But suddenly, just as she approaches me, one of the guys gets up and he whispers something in her ear, and she claps her hands, and all the girls, including Lisa, get up and they run out of the room. And one of the guys turns to me and he says, "We've got a surprise for you." Okay, so here's the funny thing about me. I am normally not the type of person who was ever at a loss for words, but usually it happens whenever I'm in the presence of my four Mormon aunts from Utah. Now, all the people on my father's side of the family are Mormon, and they all live in Utah, and they are deeply devout Mormons and deeply devout Republicans. I am not. So we've always had a very cordial, never seen, speaking, or referring to each other sort of relations. But once a year, all the aunts will fly in from Utah to go shopping, usually at Christmas. And somehow, I get roped into taking them around. I take them around Union Square, and then I take them to the Cheesecake Factory. Mormons love the Cheesecake Factory. And I look up, and Aunt Mimi, the most religious and politically fanatic of the group, is giving me this look. What? I just feel really bad for you.
Why?
Because of your lifestyle. Because of your lifestyle, you will never get to experience God's greatest miracle to heterosexuals. I said, "What are you talking about? I'm in the Cheesecake Factory, aren't I? When are you gonna have a baby?" I don't know what to say anymore. I mean, how many times can you answer the same question over and over and over again? I wish I had some sort of saucy, snappy comeback. Something Noel Coward or Oscar Wilde or even Charles Nelson Reilly. Something like, "I guess when my boyfriend grows a giant vagina." And Mimi says, "Don't you and your Spanish friend want to raise a child?" Now, my Spanish friend is Eric, my then California State Registered domestic partner of many, many years, and now my legally wedded spouse. And of course, they know it. And fuck you. Oh my gosh. Hey, listen, if you want to get us a gift, we're still registered on Craigslist. And Eric is a native of Puerto Rico and a native Spanish speaker, and they all know it because we've been together now, like 10 years or, well, 10 or 12 years, depending on how you do the math, because I stalked him for 2 years, so he's been with me for 10, I've been with him for 12. And the fact is, no, I don't want a baby. Look, if I wanted a baby, I'd get a baby. Being gay has never been any barrier to getting a child. Are you kidding me? If I had a dollar for every single woman over 35 that tried to get sperm out of me to make a baby, I'd have $3. Eric and I would consider adopting an older child, but only if he or she completed some sort of course in bookkeeping. We have troubles with our taxes, but I digress. Back at the whorehouse. Madame Ronnie Crop is coming toward me. And she got that look and says, "You ready to see the big round bend in the back?" And I'm starting to panic. I think, "What am I gonna do? I gotta get out of this." And then one of the guys gets up and he whispers something in her ears and she claps her hands and all the girls, including Lisa, get up and they run out of the room. And I think, and the guy turns to me and he says, "We've got a surprise for you." I think, I'm trapped. What am I gonna do? Even if I get out of here, I don't know where I'm basing. It's panic. And just before I get up and I make a break for it, the door flies open, but instead of the Red Army, in marches Mr. Goo, and behind him come each of the girls, and they're waving lighted sparklers in their hands, and behind him comes Madame Ronnie Crop, and she's got a birthday cake that says, "Happy Birthday, James," in Chinese and English. I am the 5 Chinese billionaires, the 6 Chinese hookers, the 1 madam with a rotting crop, and Mr. Gu saying happy birthday to me at 3 a.m. inside of a Beijing whorehouse. So tell me, how can the Great Wall of China top that?
Snap Judgment Live, the breakout special. See it for yourself right now. Watch and share these stories with your world for free. SnapJudgment.org. Subscribe to the free podcast while you're there. And all the music for this show, including this music, was composed by the amazingly magical Alex Mandel. Performed by Alex and the Snap players Tim Frick and Dangerous David Brand. Thanks as well to Anna Adamstein, Jasmine Aguilera, David Kim, Matt Ducat, our own mixologist, Pat Macidi-Miller. Show some love for the Uber producer, Mark Wistich, because even though this is not the news, no way is this the news, but this is WNYC.